Welcome to Harvesting the Great Plains, the show about discipleship across the Great Plains Conference. As Jesus said in Matthew 9, verse 37, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Now, typically on the show, we would be talking about the harvest, the discipleship across the Great Plains, but today is all about disaster response. Here in the studio with me, I have the Reverend Holly Tapley, who will share with us about what has been happening with disaster response across Kansas and Nebraska in the past several months. Holly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jana.
Now, recently you had a large group of volunteers, many of them were conference employees, who joined you for a service blitz in Fremont, Nebraska. Now, can you back up maybe and tell me a little bit about what was the situation in Fremont, Nebraska?
Well, Fremont was one of the areas that was hardest hit from the flooding that began in March. And because of the magnitude and the volunteer response of trying to do the work, Fremont was one of those that we had to work with communities to kind of get the right things put together. So this blitz was actually our second blitz. We did one earlier into the same area, removing the wet insulation and things from the home. This time, our focus was to go in to replace with new insulation underneath mobile homes and then putting skirting around them to get them winterized before the cold weather really sets in, even though it snowed on us a couple of days while we were there. But so this focus was really kind of some delayed work that began with the flooding in March.
I see. So how many people did it take and how many homes did you service?
We actually worked on 22 homes. There were 50 initially. The second day we were there, I rode around with a construction manager, Terry. We went to all 50 places. Only 22 of those were ready for the services that we were there to provide. So on Tuesday at lunch, we made it our priority. By Saturday afternoon, we were going to be done with 22. And at 5:45 p.m. on that Saturday afternoon, we finished up the 22nd mobile home.
Wow. Now, how long was it before you were able to provide the service to the people of Fremont?
Well, we've been in and out of Fremont multiple times since March, basically, though, going and doing the muck out that we call it after the flood. This trip here was the first one we've done what we call recovery work, getting the homes dried in and ready for the winter. So it was a little bit different focus on this trip.
What was the main cause of the damage? Was it the waters rising into these homes? I know that some of the damage to property was done through these major ice flows that came into neighborhoods. Tell me, what was it like when you first saw this neighborhood?
I saw Fremont, I think it was like 3 or 4 weeks after the flood. So the water was down at that time. But in this particular neighborhood that we were in, that sets 300 mobile homes, the water was up to the bottom of these mobile homes. So anywhere from 2 to 3 feet, depending on, you know, the height of the mobile home, some water did get into the main level of these homes. So, and it stayed there for several weeks before the water fully went down in the Fremont area. So
how did you get connected with this particular neighborhood?
Various ways. Of course, we have a United Methodist Church there, so connecting with the pastor, but also FEMA connected me with the director of the Fremont United Way, who was actually running the disaster recovery at that time. And so I met with the leadership pretty early on, and we just continued this working back and forth since really almost as day one.
All the way back since March?
Since March.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Is this a typical case for a disaster response team?
It's not. Basically, ERTs, or our early response individuals, are trained to be in the relief phase of the disaster. Relief phase happens after first responders go in, after disaster happens. They do their search and rescue, they make everything safe, and then response groups are asked to come in to do relief. relief work, really, you're wanting to make things safe, secure, sanitary. There's no repairs. So that's basically the first thing that happens. With this, we got into this neighborhood in kind of a God way. And so this neighborhood trusted us because of the Cross and Flame that they saw early on. And so when it came to the part of doing these repairs, some of the residents were a little hesitant about just anybody coming in. But the Cross and Flame got us in the first time. And so they trusted us to come back. So after months of conversation with Fremont United Way, I guess it was May, they started really saying, Holly, y'all got to come. You got to come do this. And I kept saying, we tear things out. We don't put things back together. We continued this conversation, Jaina, until September. And in September, at our meeting, this group is sitting here from Fremont, and they're looking at me, and they're like, what are we going to do? And I said, we'll be there. We'll come do it. So I moved us from from relief into a recovery aspect. But our ministry is built on compassion. Matter of fact, your passage of scripture, the first part of that is our verse for why we do what we do. And that is because Jesus went through the towns and the villages, and he saw and he had compassion for the troubled and the helpless. We don't want to think of them as troubled and helpless, but yet they're our brothers and sisters. And because we have compassion, we have God's compassion, then we're called. It is our passion to be compassionate to these people who need help. It doesn't matter who they are. So, you know, after all of these months of having this conversation and them saying, we have nobody else, we have nobody else. And I'm like, we'll do it. And so, you know, I came back and I sent out the notice to the ERTs, and I'm like, this is not what we normally do yet. This is why I want us to do it. And so we did.
So it was clearly a calling to you through the community of Fremont, the United Way, and through this neighborhood.
It was.
But was this so clear to your response team? Were they willing and able to do this work?
Yeah. Some of them, well, let me back up. I don't want to say some of them. There's a majority group that respond over and over and over. And they have a heart for it just as much as I do. And so I could probably say to them, we're going to go jump off a cliff because it's going to help somebody else, and they'll probably do it. So because they have the same passion for the ministry, they'll do it. I think I had maybe a couple of people say, but this is not in the scope of what we do. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I understand that. And I go back and talk about the compassion. And go back and say, if not us, then who? And that kind of wins them over.
Sure. I am sure it would. And what a powerful representation of not only the larger church and the body of Christ, but of the United Methodist Church being the hands and feet of Christ in their communities.
Exactly.
Well, in a minute, I'll have you tell me a little bit more about Disaster Response Ministry and the Great Plains Conference. Join us again in just a minute. Holly Tapley will share more about disaster response.
Stay better connected to the Great Plains Conference and track success with your spiritual disciplines by downloading and using our new app. Our primary social media channels appear on the homepage of our app. Need a daily devotion? Look no further than our link to the Upper Room, right on the home screen of our app. Our communications staff will keep you up to date on the latest stories from within the conference and beyond Kansas and Nebraska. And we'll help you stay on track with your spiritual disciplines with our Spiritual Fitness Tracker. Each time you complete one of the five disciplines, we help you measure on the app. You just click a button to get a point. To help you stay healthy, we even have a fitness tracker that allows you to record your time taking part in aerobic activity, strength training, or even counting your daily steps. Our new app will even help you track some of the foods you eat to help you maintain a balanced diet. You can measure how well you're doing spiritually, in exercise, and with your diet by checking your progress by week or month. All of this, plus access to conference videos, photos, blogs, news, and more, available at your fingertips on your iPhone or Android, or on any tablet. Download the new Great Plains Conference app today.
Welcome back to Harvesting the Great Plains. Today we're talking all about disaster response, and here with me is the Reverend Holly Tapley, Disaster Response Coordinator for the Great Plains Conference. Now, Holly, you've been a part of a disaster response ministry for quite some time, but tell me more about your volunteers. What kind of people volunteer for disaster response ministry?
It takes a special person. We'll take people who are 18 years and older, who have a desire to be in ministry to other people, people who are vulnerable, who have just gone through probably one of the most worst times of their life. Volunteers are asked to go through a training. It's CORE related. It's an 8-hour training. They have to be safe gathering certified, and they also have to be safe gathering certified through verified volunteers, which is the CORE background check. So two background checks you have to pass. One of the things with the ERTs is that we cannot plan a disaster. I wished it was that easy that on this day at this time we're going to have a disaster. So our volunteers have to be willing to pick up and to be ready to be deployed within 24 hours or earlier, depending on the situation. So that's why I said it takes a special person, because a lot of our volunteers take time off from work to come. A lot are retired, but they're busy. Oh my goodness, they're busy. So we try to get as many people we can to respond immediately, but knowing that it's going to take over the long haul to get a big group there. So ERTs come at their own expense. And we do have tool trailers, so we can cover that aspect. Also try to work with the communities we're going into for housing and for meals to keep that cost down. But it's totally a calling on their life to be able to respond.
Yeah, I didn't realize this was all at their own expense. This is not a typical mission trip where you might have some notice ahead of time and maybe some time to do a fundraiser or save up. This is something that you are willing to do at a moment's notice at your own expense.
Exactly.
To go and serve others who are, as you said, in the worst days of their lives.
Yeah. Exactly.
That takes a special person indeed. Now, about how many volunteers do we have working on a regular basis with our disaster response teams?
We have an average of about 20 that are highly devoted and that respond. We have 484 credentialed volunteers. Many of them cannot serve because of one thing or the other, but there is a core group of about 20 that have literally gone from one end of this conference to the other this year, serving in the disasters.
This has been a big year for your volunteers then, all the way from disaster response in March until now. And it seems like there's a new disaster appearing at any time.
It does.
What is it like for them when the disaster responders, first of all, do they hear that there is a disaster and off they go? How do they know when they're meant to go and respond?
Yeah, there is protocol that you follow. No, we do not self-deploy. Self-deployment brings headaches upon the community. After a certain disaster in one of our areas a couple of years ago, the emergency manager called, asked me to come, asked me to be in charge of all the volunteers, whether they were agencies like Great Plains that came in or spontaneous volunteers. The next morning at 6:30 a.m. when I walked into where my office was going to be to greet volunteers, there were 800 spontaneous volunteers lined up wanting to work. That puts a heavy burden on communities. Think about it. I mean, a community has just been through a disaster. You don't know about food. You don't know about other resources. And so people who self-deploy add to the problems.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So you don't want to put more on that emergency manager, and you don't want to put more on the community as a whole. Because if volunteers self-deploy, then you're taking away food from the community. If you stay in a hotel, then you're taking hotel rooms away from community. So, I mean, there's just many, many variables of why you do not self-deploy. We have a protocol through UMCOR and through FEMA. If a disaster happens in your local community, just say if something happened here in Topeka, then the volunteers who live here in Topeka can work in this community, because it would be known as a community disaster. They can work anywhere within the Topeka district. If it's outside of the Topeka district, or if it is outside of the Great Plains Conference, we have to be invited to come in. If it is outside of our conference, then let's say if something happened in Arkansas, then we would have to get an invitation from Byron and Janice Mann, who is my colleagues there. We would have to get an invitation from them, which would come to me, and then I could put the call out to our volunteers to help. It's a courtesy thing. Mm-hmm. Emergency managers, it's the same way. They do not want us showing up. They will call when they're ready, and when they're ready, then we deploy in. There's so much that happens after an immediate disaster that people don't think about. At one area that a tornado came through, there were 4 days before West Star could even get all the power lines off the road. It's not safe. So that's why we follow protocol. It's the reason we better not self-deploy.
Sure.
Because it's safety, but then it's a control factor also.
Sure. So not even just for a trained individual or a trained early response team. They have to wait till the resources are in place to have volunteers and make sure it's safe and not be a drain on the community or an extra burden.
Exactly.
So then maybe should I just go ahead and chip off some donations? What if
no.
I have some things
please
around my
no.
house I'd like to hand off?
Please no.
So what's the problem with just sending, just hearing there's a disaster and, you know, I'm just going to ship a box of supplies. What's the problem there?
That becomes the biggest disaster.
I see.
Number one, there's nowhere to put them. Number two, there's nobody to sort through them. There's nobody to hand them out because everybody is busy doing what you need to be doing for that disaster. And it literally, it becomes a bigger headache. Recently, I took a walk through one of the areas where a group had gathered donations for the flooding in Nebraska, and I just thought, well, I'll just take a look and see what's in here. Canned goods on a table, probably, I think there's like 20 cans left. 15 of those cans were expired.
Oh, man.
So people have good hearts, but we grab mm-hmm. and we take, and we don't know what people need. Necessities are going to be met. So people don't need to worry about that. Within the first few hours, necessities are going to be met. Emergency managers have that built into their preparation plans. One call to the State Department of Emergency Management and those needs are there. We know who can do what. And if there was a huge need, the emergency managers and the Great Plains Conference know we have a hot foods trailer. So they're going to call me and they're going to say, Holly, deploy your hot foods trailer. So we don't want things showing up, literally. In 2014, Janet, And I wish I could remember who did the research on this, but it was tracked from the disasters that year. And 75% of all donated goods during that year ended up in a landfill.
Oh, that is so disheartening.
It is disheartening.
And that was because they were sent without invitation.
Exactly.
And without real thought into maybe the best course of action for helping the situation.
Exactly. Exactly. Because you've got to have somewhere to put the things.
Uh-huh.
You know, and if a tornado comes through, you don't have, there's nowhere to put stuff. And even
sure.
with the flood this year, there was no way to really capture a lot of goods.
Right.
Hence the reason why we push financial donations.
Sure.
You know, through the Great Plains Conference. Through UMCOR, because it is quicker for us to be able to assist a homeowner and a community with financial needs, and we can purchase a good in that community and help the economy to rebound. So that is why, another reason why it's important not to do donation management. It's because we want to get them back up, and part of healing is making them sufficient again. So
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But you mentioned how there's no one to organize these supplies, or maybe there's no one to organize volunteers. What is it like when your team is invited into a disaster area and has been invited to go and start a project? What do they see when they get there?
Depends on the disaster. When we arrived in Columbus, Nebraska. Yeah, Columbus. It was after North Loop, so it was Columbus. The National Guard was still directing traffic. That is kind of a daunting thing when you... I remember driving in late, early evening, and there's the MPs at the crossroads with their guns and, you know, all of this, and they stop you and want you to identify yourself and where are you going and what are you doing and that type stuff. So it's kind of daunting to see that.
These are very controlled areas.
Oh yeah, very controlled.
Days.
It is. Because the emergency manager invited us to come in, we had access to the worst of the worst areas. And so the next day, we rode down one of the highways where a lot of the heavy flooding took place. And to see water still white capping on the side of the road, and to see what's left of homes or businesses, really, it does something to you. I mean, it kind of knocks the wind out of your sail. And I'm thinking about one particular business that literally just looked like it was just gutted out, and it was just the frame of the building there. And you see the people standing there, and you can't help but think, what are they thinking? What am I going to do? So you see things, and you hear things, and you smell things that is very abnormal.
Right.
And it's not easy. It's not easy at all.
I imagine spiritual care for yourself and your volunteers is a highly important part of what you do, and also maybe the spiritual care of the people who are there. Do you consider that part of your ministry?
Yes. We start our day with devotion, prayer, just being together. I encourage our volunteers when we're having lunch to talk, to just kind of debrief during that time, and also at dinner time to just, but we also kind of have a little pact with one another that if you're working on site and something gets to you and you need to step away, just come to me or come to another team member and say, I'm going to get a bottle of water. I'll be right back. And that's kind of our sign to know I need a little bit of time. Visibly upset people, yeah, we take care of. So it's highly important that volunteers stay grounded because it's not an easy thing to walk through.
But it sounds like you're doing such important ministry, and so many of us want to be a part of an important ministry like that. What does it take to become an early responder? How can somebody who's watching get involved?
We hold trainings throughout the year. We will not be holding any more until the first of the year, just because we're getting into the holiday winter season and winter. You know, we don't know what the winter is going to be like in the Midwest. But we hold trainings periodically, ERT trainings. We advertise them in GP Connect. They're on the conference website, Facebook. You send it out Twitter. I mean, we get it out as much as we can. District AAs, we let know about. Anybody can sign up to be a part of the trainings. We like for churches to host trainings because we need and want to get people all over the annual conference.
So a church might approach you and say, we have people who are ready and willing to be early responders. Can we host a training? And that's how those get scheduled, maybe?
Could be, yes.
So a church out there could call us up and we would get that worked out for you.
Exactly. Get a date that works for them, a date that works for one of the trainers, and we get it and go for it.
And that would become maybe a missional community within that church who would be prepared to meet as responders together and work side by side.
It is. We really want to get the network groups going and have network ERTs to support one another. Because it can be very hard. I have one volunteer that comes from the way western part of the state. And there's really nobody else there for that support system. So we want to expand our areas so that we've got every area in the Great Plains Conference covered.
Yeah, the potential for ministry and impact churches all work together through these networks, it's just never ending. There's so much they can accomplish together.
Exactly. And there's nothing better than being the church.
Nothing better than being the church,
exactly.
You're right.
And that's what we do.
Well, in a minute, I'm going to have you talk about more of your background in disaster response training, and we can talk about more about how disaster response is part of being the church. Join us when we come back. We'll hear more about Holly's story.
This Health Boost is brought to you by the Abundant Health Initiative of the United Methodist Church.
Get up, get ready. It's time for a Health Boost. Let's unite to boost our holistic well-being. Grind your mind with this 2-minute creativity crunch. Let's flex those mental muscles with this first exercise, word patterns. Starting from the top, say aloud the color of each box as fast as you can. Go! Excellent! Now keep up that pace and say aloud the color of each word. Not the word themselves, but the color in which they appear. Ready? Go! Tricky, huh? This exercise improves concentration and attention switching abilities by establishing new connections between the different hemispheres of your brain. Let's keep that mental sweat going with another mental exercise. This one's called Name Game. Name two objects that start with each letter of your first name. For example, if your name is Sam, you'll say six objects. You might say sailboat and star for the first letter, then repeat the process for the remaining letters. You can even switch it up by naming words in different categories, like foods or cities. Ready? Go! Nice job. Congratulations. You've invested in your mental health today. Your fit and flexible mind is ready to face the day with energy and creativity. Join us in creating abundant health for everyone. Learn more at umcabundanthealth.org.
We're back on Harvesting the Great Plains, where today we're focusing on disaster response across the Great Plains Conference here with the Reverend Holly Tapley, our disaster response coordinator. Now, Holly, how did you get started in disaster response? It seems like such a specific kind of ministry that maybe not all of our ministers are trained for.
All right. In the late 80s, I was in my first appointment in small town South Georgia, and a tornado had gone through a neighboring community, and I just asked a bunch of the church people, you have any desire to go and help clean up? And we did, and spent a week there, come to find out. I got the bug then. I mean, it was just something about working with homeowners. And I remember, you know, so vividly that first experience that it kind of got me. It took me, and that had became my passion. And so every church after that, whether I was doing youth or whoever I was working with, I always took us to disaster response and mission trips to help other people. So.
And then you moved on to Florida and then the Great Plains Conference. About how long have you been with us here?
About 5 years. Yeah, beginning my fifth year, I think, or in my fifth year.
Can you share some of the experiences you've had here in the Great Plains Conference?
Oh, wow. Oh, there's lots of stories. Probably some of the ones that stand out the most is after the wildfires in western Kansas. I was sitting talking to a rancher. I'm not good at guessing ages, but I'm going to maybe guess early 80s, mid 80s. I'm not good at that. But, you know, big ranchers, we're all right. We don't need help. We'll be okay. You know, we talked, and I remember I handed him my card, and I said, well, if you change your mind, if you need help, then here's my info. And about a month later, he gave me a call, and he said, I can't do it anymore by myself. And so I said, what do you need? And he still had burnt post and the burnt barbed wire that needed to be pulled up. And I remember laughing and going, I know nothing about it, but if you'll teach me, we'll do it. And we did. So we went. And helped. And then we ended up going back and helping him put new posts in and some new barbed wire. So that was quite an experience there. But the thing about it is a few weeks after that, I got a letter from him. And he said that he was ready to give up. And then we came, and he kind of got a new spark back. So that one will forever be in this old hard heart here. and I keep check on him, and he's doing good now. So that's awesome. There was another young couple that. Floods in the Mulvane area, and we help whoever and don't ask questions, and went in and helped them. And about 8 or 9 months later, called me, asked me to come by their house, and I went by, and they had decided to get married and asked me to officiate their wedding. So I got to do a wedding as a result of this. So. You know, those are two that really remain. I mean, there's more. There's You know, there's families in Columbus, Nebraska that the very first people we helped that night. There's people in North Loop, Nebraska, and Greeley and Scotia and Wood River and Dinebrog and Ord, and I've got some afraid I'm going to miss somebody, Valley and Fremont, but then in Kansas, from the flooding and the tornadoes here, I stood with what was left at a home in Lawrence, Kansas. All was left was the basement floor, and I stood on the top floor with the grandson, and the grandparents were down, and we were talking, and I said, "Well, what can I do for you? You need anything?" And the grandmother looked up and said, "We'll be okay." She said, "We have faith, and we know God will sustain us." And she said, "We'll rebuild." So it's hearing and it's seeing the faith. We have gotten wonderful volunteers because we have worked in their homes, and now they're a part of our team. A gentleman, we worked in their house after a flood. The next day, we were still working in other areas, and he drove up and started working. For the last month of his life, he was a very dedicated ERT.
The last month of his life?
He died of a massive heart attack.
Oh, my.
But he spent that last month volunteering because we had been in his house.
We talk about creating disciples across the Great Plains, and this is discipleship in action, one of many ways that discipleship takes action.
It is.
And it sounds also like we encourage others to become a part of the family of Christ with us when you are being the presence of Christ among them in these disaster response areas. You've mentioned wildfires and floods and tornadoes. Are there other types of disasters that someone can call our team to respond to?
We've done ice storms. We have helped open shelters with American Red Cross because they either could not get there and we were closer. So we have hauled water to places who had like main water breaks and put the call out for needing water, and we'd get as much as we could and haul it to wherever needs to be.
Do the responders, I know they go through training maybe to learn about the FEMA requirements or the UMCOR requirements. Are these things that people just know how to do, or do you have to have special skills to be a disaster responder?
We'll teach you. There are certain ways to do things, and we do go by FEMA regulations when it comes to how you clean out a house or how you tarp. We do, like this year, oh my gosh, with the vastness of the disasters we had to do a lot of just time training. In other words, we teach you what to do in a quick amount of times, but then we pair people up with our ERTs. We don't do that all the time, just because in the relief phase, there are certain ways you're supposed to do. FEMA requires a 6 piles of separation for debris. If you haven't been through the training, then you don't know how to do that, even though we made copies of that sheet and gave it to people this year so that they would know as they went out and about. But so, I encourage people to go through the training because you need to be badged, because there are areas that when you go into, they're going to check that badge and they're going to make sure that you are credentialed. And a lot of things, especially people who show up, they'll get turned away if they're not with an agency who is a credible agency. So that's the reason we encourage people to go through the training so that I can say to that emergency manager, or to the governor in Kansas when he came, and, you know, I've got this many volunteers that I can bring in, and that we are badged, and we are credentialed, and we do know what we're doing. And that provides a big sigh of relief.
So we have the reputation for being reliable and trustworthy, that we've taken all the right steps to be the right kind of response in this situation.
Exactly.
They know that they can count on us.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Holly, thank you so much for sharing about disaster response with us today.
Thank you.
To learn more about the disaster response blitz in Fremont, Nebraska earlier this fall, you'll want to watch the GP Connect newsletter and the conference website to see a special video. Well, that's another episode of Harvesting the Great Plains. We hope to see you next time.